you read this poem. Australia is a Saturday with races on the tranny. Australia is the talcy smell of someone else's granny. Australia is a kitty with zinc cream on its nose. Australia's voice is Melba's voice. It's also Normie Rose. Australia's famous postage stamps are stuffed with flowers and fauna. Australia is the little man who's open round the corner. Australia is a sunburnt land with sand and surf and snow. All ye who do not love her, ye know where ye can go. Barry Humphreys wrote it. Actually, I was thinking, if they actually put that up as a preamble yesterday for the election, I probably would have voted for it. I just love the line, Australia's voice is Melba's voice. It's also Normie Rose. Normie Rose, famous for lots of things. One of them is for singing on Les Mis. Another thing he's famous for, and that's punching out Ron Casey on the Midday Show. It's probably one of his greater moments. He really is an Australian icon. But it's awful when you discover your icons have feet of clay. Now, when Normie punched Ron on the Midday Show, it wasn't that bad, but when he beat up his daughter's boyfriend and was photographed on the front page of the Sun Herald coming out of the lockup, one of our icons fell. Now, it's a long way to compare Normie Rowe with Steve Roach, but in the paper yesterday, Channel 9 sacked Steve Roach for beating up somebody in a Leagues Club brawl, and another icon fell. Or when Tony Gregg made racist comments and was suspended, a cricket icon fell. Or when Lawsy was exposed on a radio icon fell. Or if you think in the world of politics, I think Alexander Downer has actually done quite a good job on the whole management of the East Timor situation as foreign minister. But when he did that Things That Batter speech, that was another icon fell. Or ex-Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser. He was discovered other side of the world, hotel room, and no trousers. And how he lost his trousers. Another icon fell. Or the way Bob Hawke treated Hazel, the former folk legend, and another icon fell. But closer to home, it's actually much worse when we're first forced to come to terms with the fact that the leaders of the people of God fall, that they have feet of clay as well. It might be the high-profile minister in the sex scandal, or it might be when your prayer and Bible study group leader, or the person who led you to Christ, gets a speeding fine, or is rude to his wife, or is rude to you, or you see inconsistencies in... As you get to know more of the Bible, you start to see inconsistencies in their life. And people who you've had of heroes, they turn out to have feet of clay. And how do you handle it when your heroes have feet of clay? And leaders, how do we handle it as leaders of the people of God? Today we see that Moses, that great Old Testament leader of the people of God, had feet of clay. We're in Numbers chapter 20. If you want to turn in your Bibles to Numbers chapter 20, and if you have that open, and you'll see there I've got an outline of the logic that I'm going to be working through in the centerfold of this little outline here, and I'm at point two, and we're in episode one of the Bible. So in terms of the whole Bible story, we're right near the beginning. And really the plot of episode one is that God is rescuing his people Israel. He's rescuing his people Israel from slavery. They've been in slavery to Egypt, and he took them out of Egypt, Moses, Ten Commandments, Charlton Heston, all that sort of thing. And now they're walking through the desert, walking through the wilderness. And there's a map of the walk from Egypt on the left-hand side, on the back here. There's a map of the walk from Egypt. Then they go through the wilderness. And I've given you the timeline of the period of walk, rest, walk, rest, walk, rest, under point two on the outline. Making us all move around a fair bit. So under point two on the outline there, you can see there's three journeys and three rests. So first journey is from Egypt. They leave Egypt, they go to Mount Sinai, where the whole Ten Commandment thing happens. And then they rest at Sinai. They rest at Mount Sinai from Exodus 19 through to Numbers 10. And then they start moving again from Mount Sinai. They move to Kadesh. That's Numbers 10 through to 12. And then they rest at Kadesh, Numbers 13 to 19. And then today we pick it up in Numbers 20. It's the journey from Kadesh to Moab. And then next week they'll be resting at Moab. So really today we're starting off the third journey in Numbers 20. And Miriam dies. Moses' sister-in-law, Miriam, dies in Numbers chapter 20 and verse 1. And we're picking it up in sentence 2 of Numbers 20. And the people of Israel are grumbling again. The Israelites are being seduced not to trust God again. Remember, that's been the reoccurring pattern. Travel, seduction, travel, seduction, travel, seduction. So Numbers chapter 20, sentence 2, there was no water for the community and the people gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron. That's a familiar pattern. Very similar complaint to the one we saw a couple of weeks ago when the Israelites were seduced from trusting God over the whole issue of food. So verse 3, sentence 3, they quarrelled with Moses and said, "If only we died when our brothers fell dead before the Lord. Why did you bring the Lord's community into this desert that we and our livestock should die here? Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to this terrible place? It's got no grain or figs or grapevines or pomegranates and there's no water to drink." They're grumbling with Moses, but really their problem is with God. God had promised to look after them, but they didn't trust him. And they're acting rashly. They know God's promised to look after him, but they're whinging out loud against the God of the universe. And they don't honour him. Because if you really trusted him, and if you really believed that this God was the God of heaven and earth, and he was committed to you as he promised to be, well, you wouldn't grumble like this. Nevertheless, God is merciful. God doesn't, in this incident, punish the people for their grumbling, for not trusting him, for acting rashly, for not honouring him. Moses, here's what they're saying, he goes to speak to God about the Israelites, about the grumbling. So you see sentence 6, Moses and Aaron went from the assembly to the entrance to the tent of meeting, that's where God lives, and they fell face down and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. And Moses is about to explain the problem to God, and the Lord said to Moses, verse 7, take the staff. Moses doesn't even get a chance to explain the problem. Take the staff, says God, and you and your brother Aaron gather the assembly together. Now this is key. Speak to that rock before their eyes and it'll pour out water. You'll bring water out of the rock for the community so that they and their livestock can drink. Now, God is prescribing mercy, not judgment. God gives Moses very precise instructions. The people have grumbled, but God has chosen to be merciful. God's chosen in his wisdom to extend mercy. And there's a happy ending to the people's grumbling, to their seduction. Even though they grumbled, even though they didn't trust God, even though they acted rashly, even though they didn't honour God. Verse 11. Check sentence 11 there. It's worth checking. Water gushed out from the rock and the community and their livestock drank. It's a happy ending. God was merciful, happy ending. But it's the next bit that I really want us to focus on tonight. And you know, think God has given instructions to Moses, and that's the bit we've just looked at, on how the people are to receive mercy. God's told Moses exactly what he wants him to do. Moses has got this very precise, very clear instruction, and instead, look what Moses does. Sentence 9. Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence, just as he'd commanded him. So far, so good. The writer's pointing out Moses is following the Lord's instruction exactly. But then sentence 10. He and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock. And Moses said to them. Look back to sentence 7, what God had told Moses to do. God had told Moses to speak to that rock. But Moses didn't speak to the rock. He spoke to the people. There's no command from God for Moses to speak to the people. Moses was told precisely, you speak to the rock. Moses was told to ask the rock for water in front of the people. But Moses doesn't do what he's told. Moses does something else. Now, there's a very clear link right through the scriptures between trust and obedience. It actually came out in the email that you, Mel, and Terry sent around this week. Terry and Mel Some of us who are on their little email junk email list got this email, but for the rest of us, I'll just give it to you. These are in the words of Mel. A man named Jack was walking along a steep cliff one day when he accidentally got too close to the edge and fell. On the way down, he grabbed the branch, temporarily stopped his fall. He looked down and to his horror saw that the canyon fell straight down for more than 1,000 feet. And the people of Israel are grumbling again. The Israelites are being seduced not to trust God again. Remember, that's been the reoccurring pattern. Travel, seduction, travel, seduction, travel, seduction. So Numbers chapter 20, sentence 2, there was no water for the community and the people gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron. That's a familiar pattern. Very similar complaint to the one we saw a couple of weeks ago when the Israelites were seduced from trusting God over the whole issue of food. So verse 3, sentence 3, they quarrelled with Moses and said, "If only we died when our brothers fell dead before the Lord. Why did you bring the Lord's community into this desert that we and our livestock should die here? Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to this terrible place? It's got no grain or figs or grapevines or pomegranates and there's no water to drink." They're grumbling with Moses, but really their problem is with God. God had promised to look after them, but they didn't trust him. And they're acting rashly. They know God's promised to look after him, but they're whinging out loud against the God of the universe. And they don't honour him. Because if you really trusted him, and if you really believed that this God was the God of heaven and earth, and he was committed to you as he promised to be, well, you wouldn't grumble like this. Nevertheless, God is merciful. God doesn't, in this incident, punish the people for their grumbling, for not trusting him, for acting rashly, for not honouring him. Moses hears what they're saying. He goes to speak to God about the Israelites, about the grumbling. So you see sentence 6. Moses and Aaron went from the assembly to the entrance to the tent of meeting. That's where God lives. And they fell face down and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. And Moses is about to explain the problem to God. And the Lord said to Moses, verse 7, take the staff. Moses doesn't even get a chance to explain the problem. Take the staff, says God. And you and your brother Aaron, gather the assembly together. Now this is key. Speak to that rock before their eyes and it'll pour out water. You'll bring water out of the rock for the community so that they and their livestock can drink. Now, God is prescribing mercy, not judgment. God gives Moses very precise instructions. The people have grumbled, but God has chosen to be merciful. God's chosen in his wisdom to extend mercy. And there's a happy ending to the people's grumbling, to their seduction. Even though they grumbled, even though they didn't trust God, even though they acted rashly, even though they didn't honour God. Verse 11, check sentence 11 there. It's worth checking. Water gushed out from the rock and the community and their livestock drank. It's a happy ending. God was merciful, happy ending. But it's the next bit that I really want us to focus on tonight. And you know, I think God has given instructions to Moses, and that's the bit we've just looked at, on how the people are to receive mercy. God's told Moses exactly what he wants him to do. Moses got this very precise, very clear instruction. And instead, look what Moses does. Sentence 9. Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence, just as he'd commanded him. So far, so good. The writer's pointing out, Moses is following the Lord's instruction exactly. But then sentence 10. He and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock. And Moses said to them. Look back to sentence 7, what God had told Moses to do. God had told Moses to speak to that rock. But Moses didn't speak to the rock. He spoke to the people. There's no command from God for Moses to speak to the people. Moses was told precisely, you speak to the rock. Moses was told to ask the rock for water in front of the people. But Moses doesn't do what he's told. Moses does something else. Now, there's a very clear link right through the scriptures between trust and obedience. It actually came out in the email that you, Mel, and Terry sent around this week. Terry and Mel, some of us who are on their little email junk email list got this email, but for the rest of us, I'll just give it to you. These in the words of Mel. A man named Jack was walking along a steep cliff one day when he accidentally got too close to the edge and fell. On the way down, he grabbed the branch, temporarily stopped his fall. He looked down and to his horror saw that the canyon fell straight down for more than 1,000 feet. He couldn't hang on to the branch forever. There was no way for him to climb back up. So Jack began yelling for help, hoping someone passing by would hear him and lower a rope. Help, help, help! Is there anyone up there? Help! He yelled for a long time, but no one heard him. He's about to give up when he heard a voice. Jack, can you hear me? Yeah, I can hear you, I can hear you. I'm down here. I can see you, Jack. Are you all right? Yeah, I am. But who are you? I'm the Lord, Jack. I'm everywhere. The Lord? You mean God? That's me. God, please help me. I'll promise. If you can get me down from here, I'll stop sinning. I'll be a really good person. I'll serve you the rest of my life. Easy on the promises, Jack. Let's get you off from there. Then we can talk. Here's what I want you to do. Listen carefully. I'll do anything, Lord. You just tell me what to do. Okay. Let go of that branch, Jack.
What?
Let go of the branch, Jack. I said, let go of the branch. Trust me. Let go.
Help, help, help. Is there anyone else up there?
Now, Mel's email goes on to make a slightly different point, but I think it illustrates trust and obedience are really tight. If I trust you, I'll obey you. Now, Moses, when he disobeyed God, it actually shows that he doesn't trust God. Now, the manifestation of his sin, it actually doesn't look that spectacular, but it was of exactly the same character as the lack of trust, the disobedience of Israel's. Moses doesn't speak to the rock. He speaks to the people. God told him to speak to the rock. Listen to what he says when he speaks to the rock, to the people, sorry. See there, sentence 9? Listen to what he says. Listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock? I mean, it actually does sound like Moses has lost his cool here. Moses is way out of line. God's God, not Moses. Moses isn't God. God told Moses what to say. God was acting mercifully. God wasn't acting abusively. But Moses acted abusively. When God told Moses what to say, God wasn't acting rashly. Wasn't lashing out in anger. But Moses did. We called this talk tonight, Seduced by Anger. Peter on the cover has put a picture of a man who is in jail for physically abusing his children. A couple of weeks ago I heard the story on the news, you probably heard it too, of father of 6-week-old twins. And you got a picture of 6 weeks of no sleep, kids being fed every 2 hours, wife's gone out, he's lost it. And he's thrown both kids against the wall, and one of them has died, and one of them has permanent brain damage. Now, when we heard this story, my heart actually went out to the bloke, because he's had no social support, he's really stressed, and pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed and stressed and lost it. And he goes to jail. And the mother's going to spend the rest of her life bringing up a mentally disabled kid. And the father's going to spend the rest of the life in jail. And it was a one-off temper flash, a one-off act of rashness. Keep your finger in Numbers 20. Come forward with me to Psalm 106. Just a few pages forward. Quite a few pages forward. Psalm 106. We're only going to spend a moment in there, so keep your finger in Numbers 20. And the psalmist, the writer of the Psalms, he's thinking back about this incident. This incident here in Numbers 20, Psalm 106, and I'm picking up in sentence 32. Sentence 32 of Psalm 106. You see there? By the waters of Meribah, Psalm 106, 32, they angered the Lord. and trouble came to Moses because of them, for they rebelled against the Spirit of God, and rash words came from Moses' lips. The psalmist judges that Moses acted rashly. Come back to Numbers 20. God would never be rash. God on many points in the Bible is angry. But God, his character is to be slow to anger, abounding in love, forgiving sin and rebellion. When God is angry, his anger is actually righteous anger. You can't hear of the murder of a baby without being angry. But what Moses did was of a different character. Moses was just a rash dummy spit. That's not the way of God. Now, I tell the story of a father lashing out at his child like that. Now, that's so far away from our everyday experience that we can't relate to it. But when we lash out in anger at somebody at work, or lash out in anger at a flatmate or a spouse, it's not the way of God. It's not the way for the people of God to behave. And it's awful to see Moses doing it, because it's just such a shock, a profound letdown, when you realise that your heroes, your icons, have feet of clay. And it's much harder when it's a religious leader, a leader of the people of God, than when it's Blocker Roach or Normie Rowe. But it actually gets worse. Moses goes on to dishonour God. So in the directions, you've got to think, the directions that God gave Moses, Moses was to come at the head of the Israelites, leading the people of God, leading the Israelites to the rock, to ask the rock for water, to speak to the rock. He was sort of to be the representative, the mediator, asking on behalf of the people for water. And all the focus was going to be on the rock. In the Old Testament, rock is a metaphor for God, common metaphor for God. So you've got in Psalm 18, the Lord is my rock, my fortress, my deliverer. My God is my rock, in whom I take refuge. He is my shield. But look at what Moses says, verse 10 of Numbers 20. Look what he says. Listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock? Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock twice with his staff. Now, just for the purpose of the exercise, imagine this lectern is the rock, and I'm Moses. Now, God has given clear... Moses is the bad guy in this story, okay? God has given clear instructions to Moses on what he's supposed to do. Just imagine you're the people of Israel. He's supposed to come on behalf of the people of Israel, leading the people of Israel, and speak to the rock and say, excuse me, please, rock, can you give us water? That's what he's supposed to do. And the focus is all on the rock. And Moses is back here with the people. But what Moses does instead is stand up here. Listen, you rebels, must we, me and Aaron, bring you water out of this rock? And then he belts the rock. It's like he's giving God a clip over the ear. See how he's dishonouring God? Moses' behaviour, it's dishonouring of God. Moses knew exactly what God's expectations of his people were. He'd spent years leading the people of God. He'd been leading them for more than 40 years. He knew that God expected his people to trust him. He knew that God expected his people to not act rashly, to be slow to anger. He knew that God expected his people to honour him. And he didn't do what was expected of him. Now, it wasn't spectacular like... it's not as if he had sex with his mother-in-law like that bloke in the Corinthian church. It's not something like that. But he didn't trust. He was rash. And he was dishonouring. Kathy, my wife, she had a friend over to our house during the week. And they're in the kitchen, Kath's making a coffee, and Kath's friend starts to make conversation with our three-year-old, Hannah. And Hannah, instead of replying to the question, stuck her tongue out at our guest. And our guest said, "That's a nice tongue." Try to overlook the fact that our daughter's being really rude. Now, her mother's having none of that. And Kath said, looked at Hannah and said, "What happens to people who stick their tongues out?" Hannah looked back at her mum and said, "They get smacked." And she looked at the guest, looked at Kath, and went, "Now, Now, it's not like she stuck her brother's head down the toilet. It's not like it's anything like that. But Hannah knew exactly what her mother's expectations were. And she knew what the consequences would be. And she defied them. And there was justice and no mercy. Moses knew exactly what God's expectations were. And he defied them. Not like he had sex with his mother-in-law, but he knew what he was supposed to do. And he defied them. And there was justice. In this little incident, these 13 verses in Numbers, we learn something of the holiness of God. See sentence 13 in Numbers 20? These were the waters of Meribah, where the Israelites quarrelled with the Lord, where he showed himself holy among them. God's holy. God's special. God's separate. He can't be mocked. He needs to be honoured as holy. And when God isn't honoured, justice must follow. You can't just stick your tongue out at God like Moses did and not expect there to be big implications. God will bring justice. God is angry with Moses' defiance. God is angry with Moses' lack of trust, his rashness, his lack of honour. Look what he says in sentence 12. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not trust in me enough to honour me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I give them. Now, Moses has two problems here. He's got one problem as a person and one problem as a leader. First, as a person, he didn't do the right thing. He didn't honour God because you did not trust in me enough. But second, as a leader, Moses did it in the sight of other people. You did not trust in me enough to honour me as holy in the sight of the Israelites. He didn't just do the wrong thing. He did the wrong thing in the sight of the Israelites. And it actually was worse because it was a leader sinning. The leader's sin has implications for their own relationship with God, but it also has implications in terms of the rest of the congregation who are watching. And as a result, the punishment is harsh. You will not bring this community into the land I'm giving them. The whole focus of the book of Numbers is about the march to the promised land. And in God's justice, Moses will not receive what he's giving the people of God. But we also see something of the mercy of God. Mercy that despite the sin of the people of Israel, remember that their sin was of the same character as Moses' God. God did give his people water. We can have a time of questions and comments in a moment. Mercy also that he didn't strike Moses with lightning then. The judgment on Moses was actually delayed by the mercy of God. I said it a couple of weeks ago, but I'll just give it to you again. God operates between justice and mercy. From our point of view, when we sin, the best we can hope for is mercy. The worst we can expect is what we deserve, which is justice. Now, that should drive us to run to mercy. Now, you put the holiness of God, the justice of God, and you throw in the sinfulness of me. I can't survive if it's done on justice. I need to pray and pray and beg and beg and ask God for mercy. And it is in the end because of Jesus that God can extend mercy. See, God's holiness, it demands that justice be exacted. But you just got to think to the death of Jesus. And in the death of Jesus, that moment when he who had no sin became sin for us, God's mercy satisfies his justice. God in his justice kills Jesus so that mercy could be extended to me. At the cross, we see God acting supremely justly and supremely mercifully. We can be forgiven by God. You and I can be forgiven by God Because in the death of Jesus, God is ultimately just and merciful. In all your thinking about Christian things, we've got to keep coming back to that moment where God's justice meets his mercy. Now, I've got a couple of things to say in conclusion, but before I give you that, do you want to raise any issue from this this passage? Question, comment? Caroline. I think that's right. I mean, it could well be the case that they have really, really provoked him. But God has told him how he wants him to respond. So, I mean, if you just put it in the context of us in the 90s, I am told to not be angry in Colossians 3. And you think, but God wouldn't know what it's like to have a mother like mine. God wouldn't know what it's like to have a brother like her. I don't have a brother or sister like mine. Yes, he would. Do you know? And even though I've got all these situations that make life really difficult for me, I'm still told not to fly off in anger. And Moses is told how God wants him to behave. Yeah, you can't actually... I mean, there's all sorts of... I can tell you all the reasons why it's okay for me to speed. It's never okay for me to speed. I'm told to obey the government. But every time I'm running late for things, I'm... It's really important that I get there on time. Conclusion. Three issues to point out. Word to travellers, word to leaders, and a word to travellers about leaders. Travellers. The Israelites are travelling from slavery in Egypt through freedom in the wilderness to joy in the promised land Canaan. And just like them, we are travelling from slavery to sin through freedom in this life to joy in heaven. Now, it may be that you haven't yet started the journey. You still might be in slavery to sin. You might not be living God's way, but living your way. Well, you tonight need to hear the call to come for the very first time to the death of Jesus. To thank God for that marvellous moment in history when God's love and justice met. In a moment, we're going to pray about that moment. But if you have started out on that journey and you're travelling through the wilderness of life, remember, it's not a bus ride you're on. It's not a luxury coach. It's not somebody driving the coach on the front of the bus and you're just sitting there comfortably enjoying the ride. It's tough walking in the wilderness. It's tough being Christian, and all the time there are things trying to seduce you off the path. We keep on being seduced to not trust God. I actually think we're going to be seduced, particularly when we are tired, to pick up on some of the things that Caroline was mentioning, when we're down, when we're depressed. That's when I'm particularly vulnerable to act rashly. I've worked out that my godliness is directly proportional to my tiredness. All the time I'm being seduced not to honour God, not to trust God, and to act rashly. Now, when I find the journey tough, well, when they found the journey tough, God in his mercy gave them water from the rock. Come forward with me. We're finished in Numbers now. Come forward with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. When we find this journey tough, God in his mercy, he gave them water from the rock. See, 1 Corinthians 10, I do not want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers, that our forefathers were all under the cloud and that they all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. the rock that nourished them spiritually was Christ, was Jesus. For sustenance for the journey to heaven, we need to keep coming back to Jesus, keep coming back to the cross. John's Gospel, chapter 7, verse 37, the Apostle writes, "On the last and greatest day of the feast, Jesus stood up and said in a loud voice, 'If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink.'" A couple of chapters earlier, in John chapter 4, Jesus offers a woman living water. He says, "Whoever drinks this living water I give him will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become a spring of water welling up to eternal life." But we, like them, need to keep coming back to the rock, keep coming back to the life source, keep coming back to the water, if we want to have a right heart on the journey. If we don't want to get seduced off the track, we need to keep coming back to Jesus. To keep remembering and meditating on the fact that where the justice of God and the mercy of God meet is Jesus. There's that great old Christian hymn, "On Christ the solid rock I stand, all other ground is sinking sand." It's nourishing ourselves on Jesus that will keep us from being seduced to lack of trust, to rashness, to dishonour. And we've got to be careful in the little things. We mustn't be tempted to think, this one little thing doesn't matter. God won't mind if I just push the accelerator now. Or the flashes of anger with the uncooperative person at work. And I think this is particularly crucial if you're in a position of leadership. And in our democratized fellowship, lots of us are in leadership. When Moses sinned, what he did was wrong. But it was compounded. Because as a leader of the people of God, he didn't honour God in the sight of the people. So the Apostle James writes in James 3, chapter 1, "Not many of you should presume to be teachers, my brothers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly." Moses rightly is judged more strictly than the rest of the Israelites. He knew more. He had a better understanding. God had higher expectations. So what can we say about Christian leadership? There really are clear guidelines as to who should be appointed to leadership within the Christian community. Come to 1 Timothy 3. Just a couple of pages on past 1 Corinthians. This is the passage that Peter read for us a few minutes ago. So when you get to Thessalonians, keep going. It's Thessalonians, Timothy, Titus, which I've discovered is alphabetical. So 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1. Here's a trustworthy saying. "If anyone sets his heart on being an overseer, he desires a noble task. The overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not given to drunkenness, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own family well, see that his children obey him with proper respect. If anyone does not know how to manage his own family, how can he take care of God's church? He must not be a recent convert, or he may become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. He must also have a good reputation with outsiders, so he'll not fall into disgrace and into the devil's trap. Deacons likewise are to be men worthy of respect, sincere, not indulging in much wine, not pursuing dishonest gain. They must keep hold of the deep truths of the faith with a clear conscience. They must first be tested, and if there is nothing against them, let them serve as deacons. In the same way, their wives are to be women worthy of respect, not malicious talkers, but temperate, trustworthy in everything. A deacon must be the husband of but one wife, must manage his children and his household well." Interesting. Only one gift is required of a Christian leader. Only one ability is required of a Christian leader. And it's the ability to teach. All the other requirements are character. We must not put people in positions of leadership over the people of God. I'm not just talking church pastors, I'm talking Bible study group leaders, I'm talking mission team leaders, I'm talking people doing one-on-one studies. We must not put people in positions of leadership over the people of God who do not meet the character requirements. Well, you say, well, what if a leader does sin? What if a teacher does sin? What if they do have feet of clay? Well, if a leader sins, they should withdraw from leadership. Not withdraw from fellowship. Not withdraw from the church completely. I don't mean that. But withdraw from the position of leadership. Let me unpack this. Come forward to 1 Timothy chapter 5, just on the next page. 1 Timothy 5, verse 17. The elders who direct the affairs of the church well. 1 Timothy 5, verse 17. This is worth us all turning up. We're going to stop on this verse for a minute. 1 Timothy 5, 17. The elders who direct the affairs of the church well are worthy of double honour, especially those whose work is preaching and teaching. First honour is respect. The second honour is financial payment. For the scripture says, do not muzzle the ox while it's treading out the grain, and the worker deserves his wages. And just a little aside, it's going to take us off the point for a sec. But as a congregation, we need to have a serious discussion about that verse, because I think we've got problems on that verse. But I'm not going to go down that line now, because it'll take us off the subject. But the next verse is the one I want us to focus on. Verse 19. Do not entertain an accusation against an elder unless it's brought by two or three witnesses. Those who sin are to be rebuked publicly so that the others may take warning. So Paul is saying leaders who sin should be publicly rebuked so that others can be warned. More is expected of the leader. There is a double standard. Moses' sin had implications for himself, but it also had implications for the wider people of God. Let me read to you from the Sun Herald, page 3 of the Sun Herald from last year, 19th of July last year. An Anglican minister has been sacked from his parish amid wild allegations of prostitution and immoral behaviour. The Reverend David Bradley, a father of six, has been stood down from St Aidan's Parish in Inner West Annandale and has had his licence to conduct church services revoked. Despite the consternation of church officials, he continues to conduct Anglican funeral services across Sydney. He was dismissed because I no longer had confidence in him as a minister beyond reproach because of his immoral behaviour, his former boss, Canon Robert Forsyth, from St Barnabas Church on Broadway, said yesterday. He has no licence to practice as an Anglican clergyman in the Diocese of Sydney. Canon Forsyth confirmed that loss of confidence was the reason for the sacking, but also said Mr. Bradley's immoral behaviour became intolerable. If you are set aside to spend your life teaching and preaching the Word of God, more is expected. When anyone sins, we must work, Galatians 6, to try and restore them to fellowship. We must be careful that we're not tempted, careful not to follow them down that line, and careful not to get proud. But leaders who sin, 1 Timothy 5, verse 20, those who sin are to be rebuked publicly so that others might take warning. Yeah, David's sin damaged his family, himself. But because he was a leader, so that others might take warning, so that other potential leaders might take warning, the rest of the people of God need to hear that what he did was wrong. And so leaders in this fellowship, potential leaders in this fellowship, take warning. Be warned. It is no light thing to be a leader in the people of God. Remember James 3. Not many should presume to be teachers. Those who teach will be judged more strictly. If you are a leader in this fellowship and engage in ongoing sin, I will urge a public rebuke. And I'll do it because if I sin, I want you to urge a public rebuke of me. And because I'm terrified of you publicly rebuking me, hopefully I'll feel warned and I hopefully won't go down that line. So finally, a word to travellers about leaders. Don't be surprised to discover that leaders sin, just like the people of God. Moses' sin, it was of the same character as the sin of the people of Israel. I remember how let down I felt the first time I heard a Bible study group leader use a four-letter word. I heard my Bible study group leader tell a sexist joke. We mustn't put our leaders on such pedestals that we can't cope when they fall. Don't put me on a pedestal. Don't put Roberta on a pedestal, Kingsley on a pedestal, Peter Coe on a pedestal. Don't put the rest of the Bible study group leaders on a pedestal. I'm keenly aware of my own ungodliness. And I'm preaching as much to me as to you when I say this. Leaders, hear the warning. Members, don't look to the leaders for your spiritual nourishment. Look to the rock. Look to Christ.